Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The words when I spoke to my mum and dad about, because my mum's so passionate about football. And when I said to her, Mum, it looks like I got an opportunity to sign for Arsenal. Why Arsenal? I'm Nigel Winterburn, ex-professional footballer.
Yeah, thanks. Nigel, I wonder how you would describe yourself as a player to someone who was too young to have seen you play. How would you ever describe yourself?
Committed, aggressive, made the most of my ability, a passion to play football, as I still have, even at 55 years of age. Still as competitive now as I was when I was probably 10, 12, 14, going through to joining Birmingham and then on to Arsenal and West Ham. So, yeah, probably that's the best way to describe me, but quite quiet and a different person off the pitch.
And do you think that competitive spirit and that aggression, it was absolutely key into you having the career you had?
Yes, and I think also part of it was at a very, very early age being released by Birmingham City as well,
right,
which gave me the drive to prove quite a few people wrong. So if you think about losing a game of football, it's really not significant to thinking that, you know, when you get released from a club and I had a bad game, I just put the two together and remember how painful that was.
Try and maintain some perspective, basically.
Yeah, and then work from there back to regaining top form, which was, you know, to drive you forward.
What was the story behind you being released from Birmingham? How old were you at the time?
Well, I got picked up by Birmingham about 3 months before I left school.
Right.
So I was actually looking for a job.
Think you were going to become a professional?
No, I didn't think. No. I was from a small village. I was literally playing men's football. I was playing for my local team. I was playing for a team near me as well, Sunday League football. Obviously, I was playing for my school team and Nuneaton Schools. And one Saturday afternoon, I got selected to play for Nuneaton Schools. And after we'd played the game, a scout from Birmingham City came up to me and said that with my parents, he'd been watching the game and would I be interested in going over for a trial with Birmingham. So I did two trials with them, and I was a midfield player. And in the first trial, it was literally just a group of of players that they'd selected, young players, they literally picked two 11-a-side teams. There was about 28 of us there, so obviously everyone wasn't getting a game. And they didn't have a left-back for one of the teams. It was only they, from what they'd selected for the trial, there was only one left-back. And so they sort of asked who, if anyone was willing to play in left-back. So I just really thought, do you know what? There's usually a lot of midfield players around.
Yeah.
I've got the opportunity. There's a good chance I'm going to play. If I've only got one left-back, and I'll say I'll play left-back, that makes the second one, I could get to play the whole game.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, play the whole game rather than a bit of the game is going to put you in the spotlight a little bit more. So I just said that I would play there. And I played the first game, and after the game, they invited me back for another trial. We did a similar sort of thing. They had another game, but this time they said to me, oh, no, you're playing left-back in this game. I played left-back, and at the end of the trial, they invited me to sign apprentice forms for them.
Mm.
So that's really
how it really started. And that point, because you'd had a taste of the biscuit, were you thinking at that point, right now, this is the career for me type thing?
Once I... not even a career, but given the opportunity just to sign as an apprentice at a professional club.
Mm.
I mean, all I ever thought about was playing football, but not professionally.
Yeah.
So for me, it was like a dream.
Yeah.
You know, go and work somewhere, or go and work and do something you absolutely love, even at that very, very young age. You know, I'm what's coming up 16, so I'm nearly coming up 17.
Yeah.
Leaving school. Thinking what you're going to do, and then get that opportunity. And I was like, yep, thank you very much. Mm. I'll take that. And my contract at that time was £12 a week.
Right.
And £12 a week driving expenses.
Was it? Okay,
it's absolutely different world. It's a different world.
What do you think you got were released from the club?
Well, what happened was that Jim Smith was the manager at Birmingham City. So at the end, you know, I was getting some rave reviews in that first season. And at the end of the first season, I got took off the apprentice contract, signed a pro contract.
Mm-hmm.
Started to that second season. Mark Dennis was the left back at Birmingham at the time. And he got injured. And Jim Smith called me in on a Friday morning and said, like, I'm going to, like, you're playing in the first team. Did all the stuff on the Friday at the training ground. We travelled to, I think it was Brighton we were playing. Travelled down on the Friday. Saturday morning, he called me into his room and said, like, I still think you might be a little bit too young, so I'm going to change. I'm going to put, it was Archie Gemmell, actually. He put Archie Gemmell left back.
Right.
He said, I'm going to make you sub for the day.
What were you, 18 at the time?
Coming up to 18.
Yeah.
Okay. And, so obviously I was gutted, but still privileged to be part of that first team. So I was sub for that game. And then obviously after that, Mark Dennis regained fitness. He came back in. Shortly after that, Jim Smith got the sack.
Mm.
Ron Saunders came in. And literally the players that were sort of youth team come reserve team players, there was about 12 of us in the period. I remember getting called into his office and he just basically said, we don't think you're good enough. We're going to release you at the end of the season. Obviously, we'll circulate your name and you know, see if we can put you up with, get you sorted out with another club. But they're not really that interested in once they decide that you're not good enough.
When you look back on that through 2019 eyes, you look at yourself as an 18-year-old and I have no idea what type of kid you were at 18, but do you not think that's the way that's been dealt with there is really harsh?
Yeah, it's brutal.
Yeah,
absolutely, because you've got that excitement of literally when you first join the club. As I said to you, something about professional football, even at that, you know, even at the signing as an apprentice, the chance to go in every single day, train, and then play at the weekend, sometimes in midweek, getting to do something you want to do, and then a year and a half to 2 years later, you're being told, well, actually,
yeah,
this is, you know, you're not good enough to do this, which still happens.
Do you think a lot of kids would have retreated into their shell hearing that news and never had a career after that because it would have affected them so badly?
Possibly. I mean, you know, as I say to you, and I think a lot of people as well, they use agents and they rely on the clubs. Yes, the clubs send out a form to circulate your name that you've been released, but to me, it was about being proactive then. Yeah. And I was straight, as soon as I'd been released at the end of, you know, obviously I got released and I straight on the phone to Jim Smith, who had moved to Oxford.
Mm.
And I literally said, look, I've just been released. Is there any chance you would consider that I can, for the start of the following season, could I just come down and train? I just need somewhere to train, see if I can find a club. And then he said, yeah, just give me a call again, like sort of start of July, and you can come down and train. And he was absolutely fantastic with me. They put me up in a house in Diggs. I went in to meet him first day, first training session, and he just said, look, we'll give you a 6-month contract. It's not a problem. Let's see where we get to. And I'd been there for about 3 weeks, and he said to me that Wimbledon were looking for a left back.
Mm.
Their left back at that time, with Wimbledon coming up through non-league and into the lower leagues, had gone away. I think it was Norway. They said had gone. Right. They got into these playoffs, and Dave Bassett was looking for a left back for the pre-season because he wasn't going to be back in time.
Right,
it's absolutely incredible. It's crazy. The story is just incredible.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, well, I've got a 6-month contract at Oxford.
Mm.
I've got another club in Wimbledon that potentially I've got the opportunity to sign for as well. So I went straight down to, after 3 weeks at Oxford. I went straight down to Wimbledon. And I know for sure, because Dave Bassett tells the story for a while, he said, I met this unassuming, quiet young man on the motorway in his car, and I'm thinking, what's Jim Smith done to me here? So he said I was a bit reluctant to put him in any of the teams because I thought he, you know, and I needed to watch him a bit in training because I thought he might get
eaten alive
by some of my players. Yeah. But he said, just when I think one of the players got injured in one of the games. He said, I just got to put him on.
Yeah.
I'll have to put him on, just try him. And he said, I just put this young lad on. He said, it was just like the character just changed. He said, it was just like, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. He said, it's like this guy just became so aggressive.
Yeah.
It was just like he was in love with the game, and he just said there and then, I've just got to sign him. So.
When I did some research around before I knew we were going to be doing this, everyone said the same thing, that you're the nicest man, but on the pitch you were like insanely intense.
I think my wife describes it as you are a different monster.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Do you consider yourself part of the crazy gang? Fully paid up member?
Well, I think that terms of the players I was with, I think the word the crazy gang came about a bit more after they won the cup final.
That's
which
right.
Obviously I left the year before, but it was certainly crazy.
Yeah. Am I right in saying you were supporters player of the year every season you were there?
Yes, I was, yeah.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, very proud of it. Four years running.
Yeah.
I think, but after the third time, I think the 4 years, they just gave it me out of sympathy. But I mean, you know, to be honest with you, I loved it at Wimbledon.
Mm.
I mean, you know, we only got 6,000 supporters at home. We probably took a couple of hundred away. But I think it mirrored the start of my career where everybody sort of hated Wimbledon. Everybody expect them to lose every single week.
Mm.
We were always tipped to be relegation favourites.
Mm.
And it was a team that was put together by players that had been rejected, really, a lot of them. Mm. Harry Bassett put a great team together. It knew its limitations, but boy, did it have a togetherness. It worked hard and it scared a lot of teams, and a lot of teams couldn't deal with it. And I think that sort of drove me to want to be successful within that team as well, because of what had happened with me at Birmingham. So it just pushed me, kept pushing and pushing as hard as I could.
Do you think the team became greater than the sum of its parts just because of this reputation and this team spirit that you'd fostered there?
Nobody wanted to play us.
Yeah.
That's for sure, particularly at Plough Lane. I mean, when you've got Vinnie Jones and Fashanu in your team, Dennis Wise, I mean, you know, some of these guys were coming, particularly with Finney and Fash, and they would like to mix it up a little bit. So I think our reputation as a team and the way we played long ball into the corners and then get the ball down and more or less play as you want in the final third, but you know, don't lose the ball in your own half. But people hated playing that way. Yeah. They knew they were in for a physical battle, had to be very, very committed, and a lot of players didn't want to match that.
How, I mean, one question I've always wanted to ask a member of this Wimbledon side of this era is how Dave Bassett was able to keep harmony in the dressing room with so many big characters. Now, I'm not saying you weren't all pals and you didn't get on, but in my experience, when there's a lot of big personalities in like an enclosed space, it can be quite difficult to manage. Yeah, how did he do that?
I don't know. I think we all realise where
we
came
from. Were there just bust-ups all the time?
I don't know whether it's so much bust-ups, because we did some crazy things with Dave Bassett. I remember playing, you know, a British Bulldog on a Friday morning in training after the team was selected,
right,
for the Saturday, and the players that weren't playing, you could see there was a lot of aggression there,
trying to get someone injured.
Trying to get someone injured. Yeah. Saying I could get in the team here, and a lot of tag where it turned out to almost full force rugby.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a lot of crazy things going on.
Yeah, but he was good at sort of managing the egos.
Yeah, I think Dave was crazy anyway as well. He just let it go and let the players sort it out. But it wasn't not really that many. I can't think back and think of too many altercations when I was there, if I was honest. But you're saying you're right. I mean, there were some big characters there as well.
Were you always as intense in training as you were in games?
No.
Okay, right.
Terrible.
Were you? Weren't a good trainer?
No, I was bad.
Were you?
Yeah, to start with.
So you really came alive on a match day. So
yeah,
to understand you as a player, a manager needs to have seen you play a match, basically.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
If you see me in training, you definitely don't sign me.
Okay, right.
That's for sure. I'm probably last pick at five-a-side.
Okay, right.
And if I got the option, I'd usually go in goal rather than be out on a pitch. But that did that sort of... But for me, the excitement was the match day.
Sure.
The build up to it, walking out of that tunnel with the crowd, that edge that it gave you, that little bit of the knot inside your stomach. You're super confident in what you can do, but you're not quite sure of the outcome, and you've got teammates around you that have got to pull as hard as you're pulling to make sure that you get the result. And that's if you speak to most people that have played with me or know me very, very well, is match days when I come alive.
You're a different animal.
When the battle begins, I'm ready to play.
Do you think people have certainly of my age, And around that age, will know of Dave Bassett as a coach because of what happened at Wimbledon. Do you think he gets enough credit for what he did there? Because people kind of think of that era as a bit more of the stories rather than what they achieved, don't they?
Probably not, but I'd hope to think that if they look back and read the history of the club...
Rate him as a manager?
Yeah, I did, because to get a group of guys in that a lot of them have been rejected by other clubs, pick them up, bring them in, mould them together. You might not agree with the style he played. I mean, listen, now I'd hate to watch that style of play, but when you're involved in it, when you're winning, when you're travelling up through those leagues and you're trying to prove people wrong, you just go with the style, particularly if you're in the team every single week as well. You know, that helps.
Did you not ever think, I'd quite like to play this inside and go on the overlap and try and get a few more crosses?
Well, listen, you had that. I mean, we did that on many, many occasions, but, you know, there was a system to play. You could break the system and play, but if you lost the ball breaking the system...
You're in trouble.
You're in trouble.
Yeah.
But if you broke the system and it all worked out okay...
Yeah.
Then he was fine with that. There was a basis there to play. This is how you want to play. But if something else was on, and you saw that within a game, and you did it, and it worked out fine, then you know, there's not a lot you can say about that.
No. Would you get a fine if you kept doing it and losing the ball though?
I don't think you got a fine, but you'd get a bit of what I'd class as harsh words that probably wouldn't be accepted
these days
in modern football.
That's an interesting point, actually. I've never had an ex-pro in here who hasn't said one of the problems is these days that the youngsters, they don't clean the dressing rooms, they don't clean the boots, they don't want that kind of stuff anymore, and they should. And I'm sure you would agree with that, right?
Yeah, I do. I think it's... I think it's an education in where you are in life, where you are within the pyramid of, let's say, your football club. Mm. So it was no different to me at Birmingham. When I went in as apprentice, I was given six players. Mm. It's clean their boots. Which clean the boots, you then go in, you may have assigned another duty of getting the kit ready, take to the lady or the gentleman who needed to wash the kit, get the kit ready for next training session. And then on a Friday, if there was a Saturday game, you'd go to the ground. Someone would be assigned to clean the minibus, someone would clean the home dressing rooms, away dressing rooms, toilets, baths, whatever. You were assigned a job. And I think that was, to me, that's part of like the pyramid of being a footballer. And then once you step onto the next level, those duties, if you like, diminish. Mm. And then once you become, the aim is to be, for me, the aim was, well, I want to be one of the top players. I want somebody to clean in my boots.
Why don't you think they do it now?
They call it health and safety, don't they? I don't know. For me, I think it's a fantastic grounding.
Education,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, some of the players, you want to throw the boots back at them. Whose boots you're cleaning, but a lot of them were very appreciative of what you're doing. I used to have to knock on the dressing room door before you went in. You didn't just walk in as a young kid.
I think it was Mickey Gray was saying to me he wasn't actually allowed in the dressing room, the first team dressing room, at any point until he was named in the squad.
No, you don't. I'm talking about training Monday to Friday. Mm. You did not go in the dressing room until, if those players were in there, you knocked or you waited until they were all gone.
Right,
and then you went in and got the boots. But if you wanted to go in or had to go in and get the kit, you just knocked on the door. That was like polite. I just need to come in and get the kit.
On the flip side of that, what do you make of the? I was actually going to go on to ask you about the way that young players are looked after now is surely better than it was then. There's not as much harassment, intimidation, bullying, that kind of stuff. Now I understand there's, I suppose, two schools of thought. One is that they want to toughen you up because it's a harsh world out there. Mm. To play in front of all those people, you got to be thick-skinned. But the other school of thought is that you got to really look after these kids because they are kids. I mean, not a lot of that sort of seems to go on as much now. They seem to be a lot better looked after.
No, I mean, we are hearing of late, aren't we, over the last, particularly I would say over the last 2 or 3 years, of a lot of cases of within football, particularly from players who initially were scared to come forward, very, very young, being bullied by coaches. That's not acceptable.
Did you witness that happening?
I've never witnessed it.
Right.
I must admit. But then it then becomes part of, so what is bullying? Mm. You know, if
it's different for different people, presumably.
And also there's a different level. So, you know, you would often be, the coach would often be effing and blinding at you or shouting at you.
Yeah.
Maybe make you go and try on your own. Mm. No, that could be classed as bullying.
Mm. I wonder if it's partly to do with the fact that there's, at the top clubs particularly now, the academies are so multicultural now, so international. Yeah. So there's different cultures, different things.
In a way, I love what's now happening. I wish when I was a kid, if I could have got picked up at, let's say, 5, 6, 7, 8, I'm not even sure what age they start at, but such a young age. If I could go in, if I was picked up to go into a club and have what I class as professional coaching.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I was never taught to be two-footed.
No.
I mean, I used to go out in the garden or in the park on my own, bashing a ball against the wall. But if someone's saying to you, you've got to be two-footed now, you've got to do this, this is what we're trying to do. Mm.
By the time you were picked up by Birmingham, you had no professional coaching at all? None at all.
No. Nothing at all. I mean, I said to you, I was literally playing, most of my football was with my local village team.
Mm.
And then on a Sunday morning, I played for a Sunday league team in Eton as well. So I don't know, no coaching.
I suppose when you hit 16, 17, a lot of top coaches would say it's quite late to be introducing new things to people at that point.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why now you're thinking, I'd love to have got in at that age. But I suppose the flip side, and for me it's probably more for the parents to deal with, is that's the start.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got to guide your son, daughter along this journey, almost letting them know along the way that how do you tell somebody that you're probably not going to
succeed? Yeah.
You're not going to succeed, you know. But I always say to young kids when they talk to me is success is not about being at one of the big clubs. Success is being pushing yourself to get to the highest level that you can get to, if you want to, with any sport.
Yeah.
So if, in terms of football, if your level is non-league, the national league, then if you've done everything you can to get to that level, then you've achieved you've achieved your goals. So
it's the same in life, really, isn't it? You try your best and do whatever you can, and some people, achieve amazing things, and some people, don't as much, but they get the best out of it that they can. Yeah,
yeah. But I think from what I would say is, from the young players that get the opportunity, don't waste it.
No,
don't throw it away. Mm. It can, as quick as it's given to you, don't worry about it. It comes to Rufus.
Yeah,
it goes fast, but it can be taken away from you very, very quickly.
In lots of different ways as well.
In lots of ways.
Yeah.
Not being good enough.
Injury.
Attitude.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Mental strength.
Yeah.
You know, which we haven't even touched on in football, is particularly at the very, very top level, is so, so key to being able to stay at the top level for so long.
When you, in 1987, of course, you left Wimbledon and moved to Arsenal under George Graham to take on probably one of the easiest gigs in football, a long-term replacement for Kenny Santom, who who was captain of Arsenal at the time. I think England's most capped left-back as well.
Mm.
And they said, Nigel, you're the man for this job. Can you please come in and do it? How did you feel about that at the time?
I didn't really think about it, if I was quite honest.
Right.
I probably wouldn't have signed if I'd have really.
Yeah.
Once I knew, because what had happened was, not a lot of people, I don't talk about it a lot, that is 2 weeks before that, I'd gone to Chelsea for talks.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they wanted to sign me, but that all fell apart. I have no idea.
Who was the coach at the time?
I can't even remember back. I blank it out so much.
Okay, right.
Yeah. You'll have to look back. I tend to find in life that with me is that if things don't go well, the best way to deal with it is to block it out.
Move past it.
Think of the, then I relate to, I always relate to being released at Birmingham. That's the only thing I look for in terms of if I want to try and then achieve something.
Yeah,
that to really push me to that. But I actually can't even remember if I'm honest with you who was there at the time.
For the Chelsea fans listening who are shouting at their radio now, it was John Hollins.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it was John Hollins, but it wasn't John Hollins I dealt with when I went there.
So they just went cold on that today. And
yeah, I assume so.
Did you have an agent?
Or maybe I asked for too much money. Yeah. No, I went on my own.
Did you?
Yeah. I went on my own. I took a little bit of advice, as you do, but. You know, and actually, I think maybe a few days after that, they signed Tony DiRigo.
Okay, yeah.
So they were obviously eyeing up us both.
Yeah.
And maybe he was a better option at the time. And then literally after that, I got a call from Sam Haman.
Did you really?
Yeah, chairman of
Wimbledon at
the time. Who's someone I got on really well with.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we've accepted a fee from Arsenal and you need to get yourself over there and meet up with George Graham. And once I walked into those marble halls.
Everyone talks about that. Yeah, and George's office and the big door.
The big door, and the intimidation of desk, of sitting in front of him. And everything I was going to say and everything I wanted was just gone within an instant.
Was it?
It's just like everything was blur.
Yeah.
And it was like, I can't even remember how much they offered me. And then it was like, I'm just going to sign. This is just where I want to be.
Was it really? Is that impressive?
So
you didn't have any affinity with Arsenal before that? No, none of your family supported them or anything? Or?
No, I think the words when I spoke to my mum and dad about, because my mum's so passionate about football.
Hmm.
And when I said to her, Mum, it looks like I got an opportunity to sign for Arsenal.
Mm.
Why Arsenal?
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, why? I was like, no, it's just, it just feels like I've got this. It's just a massive club.
Yeah.
When you walk into those marble halls, it's just, it just sort of
So it was an easy decision for you then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's the next level. Well, it's not even the next level. It's
the level above the next level.
It's you're going to one of the very, very best.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
What was first day of training like at Arsenal?
Intimidating, sort of back into my shell a little bit, I think, and then realisation that I'm going to have to change my training methods.
Did you have a method at that point?
The method was to take it as easy as possible.
Yeah.
But when you've got Kenny Sampson in front of you and you're at a new club, a big, big club, you know, that's not going to go down too well as a new boy.
And Big George wouldn't have stood for that anyway.
George wouldn't have stood for that, no. And I found, for 6 months, to be honest with you, I found it really difficult.
Right.
I found it really hard.
Was it noticeable to step up in quality and training and the rest of it?
Yeah. The quality was and the way things were done was so different. But I think the biggest thing for me is when I always look back was I missed the atmosphere on a match day.
Right.
You know, going to play for the reserves at Arsenal, there's a couple of hundred people there, maybe 1,000 if you're lucky.
Mm.
And I couldn't deal with it.
Right.
There was no atmosphere. It felt as if it was a bit of a meaningless game.
Yeah. So your intense kind of character couldn't relate to it.
I couldn't, you know, although, you know, I know where the end goal is for me is to get into that first team.
Mm.
But those 6 months were so difficult.
Mm.
And I questioned many occasions to myself whether I'd made the right decision.
Right.
But the club itself, in terms of walking in, I knew it was the right club.
Mm.
But just the trying to adapt to what I'd class as playing reserve team football, different way of training for not only intensity, but the way that I had to push myself to train, I think was a culture lesson, if you like, to start with. And then I just got that break after 6 months.
Do you think I might not be good enough here? They might have made
a mistake. No, I didn't think I wasn't good enough. I was questioning whether I could actually mentally see it through,
right,
to be able to get the opportunity to play in the first team, because that's all I was interested in.
Sure.
And then I started to get one or two opportunities. George had decided to put me in at right back.
Was Viv Anderson playing there at the time?
No, I think Mickey Thomas had been
Mickey
Thomas had been playing there.
Okay.
um, Viv had gone. Viv had already left. And then what had happened was George had started to get rid of the more senior players. Obviously, yeah. Kenny was still there. Graham Ricks was there. Steve Williams was there. But he was starting to sort of try and move these players on. But I got in at right back. That was an education in itself for someone that didn't use his right foot.
Did you enjoy that?
Yes and no.
But when you say, Nigel, when you say you didn't use your right foot, for people listening who will never play professional football, as well as I would never play professional football, what level are we talking about here? Because when you say it like your right foot, it's like a golf club and it's just a swinger. Seriously, you had some kind of basic ability with your right foot, for sure.
Not a lot,
really?
If I'm honest. Yeah, yeah, it's just something I stood on. But I was so confident in...
Your left?
I was so confident in my ability.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Obviously, I'm so strong on my left compared to the right.
Yeah.
There's just no comparison. And I had no coaching.
Yeah.
So to try and change it, I mean, I used to go out and, as I said to you, I used to go out and practice right foot at home on my own.
Yeah.
But it's just as if the brain wouldn't click.
Could you not ping a straight ball down the line with your right foot then?
Probably not, no.
That's crazy. The people listening will find that crazy because you had such a great career.
Yeah, well...
At left back.
Yeah. And then George said, oh, like, I'm going to play you right back.
Right.
Yeah. It is bizarre.
Did you do all right there?
I must have done all right because I played a fair few games. I played for the rest of that season. Occasionally, when George left Kenny out, I switched over to left back and then I went back to right back. So I played four or five games at right back and then switched to left back for a game until the start of that following season when Kenny was gone.
Mm.
And then really that was my opportunity.
Mm.
And then we started to really do with George, a new back four coming together. We started to do a lot of work.
Mm. Was David O'Leary there still at the time?
David O'Leary was still there, yeah. Tony was there, Steve Bold came in.
Would David O'Leary play in sort of holding midfield then drop into the...
Dave was sort of in and out of the team. We did a lot of work with a back four. Occasionally went to a back five.
Yeah.
Dave would come in there into that back five right in the middle because he was good on the ball.
Yeah.
But mainly we did a lot of work just back four, movement together.
Yeah.
Distances between each other, keeping the distances the same, whether you went side to side or forwards or backwards.
Yeah.
You know, it's simplicity. But George was relentless on it. I mean, we spent hours and hours out on a pitch without a ball on the ground.
Right.
Just the four of us walking through positions.
It's curious, isn't it, Nigel? Because George Graham wasn't like that as a player, was he?
No, but I think he knew what he wanted as a manager.
Yeah. He was way before my time, but he was kind of a mercurial midfield player-ish, was he?
Yeah.
He wasn't a defender, was he?
No. He's a tackling player.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They used to call him the stroller, didn't they?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That tells its own story.
That tells its own story, doesn't
it? Yeah,
So maybe he thought, well, 11 of those in a team's not going to get he's not going to get too far.
No.
But his attention to detail was incredible.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Unbelievable. And I think he realised with the senior players, he would never be able to do what he wanted to do.
Mm.
And he brought in younger players, hungry players, a lot of them from lower leagues as well to start with, and then mixed it up a little bit with a lot of the sort of youth players that were coming through. You like some, you know, Tony was there, Mickey Thomas there, Dave Rocastle, Merce was there.
Mm.
They brought in Alan Smith.
Yeah.
I think George had a clear idea and a vision of who he wanted and where he wanted the team to go in terms of playing style and how he wanted to push the club forward.
And Arsenal hadn't won a league title since 1971, and then Nigel Winterburn comes in, and just two short years later, I think it was, you get a league title under your belt.
Yeah, it's pretty...
Is that a coincidence or...
If I was big-headed, I'd say no, wouldn't I? But no, I mean, it's just the sheer hard work that we'd put into the team, the players that had come in, formation that we were playing. We were relentless. We were hungry.
Mm.
We had a great togetherness within that team. We almost blew it. We should have won the league.
Two or three
games before that. I think we did. We drew with Wimbledon. Which was the first time I'd ever used my right foot and scored.
Right, yeah.
And then...
You played every game that season, didn't you?
I don't know if I played every game, but close to it. I don't look back at records.
Do you not? Okay.
No. Not really.
Do you remember, for example, who your debut was for Arsenal against?
Yeah, it was... Well, actually, my debut, I actually came on for Niall Quinn. I was a sub.
Right.
And Niall Quinn went on as a sub. Hmm. And we lost to Southampton at home. And then Quinny got subbed as a sub. And
did
I went on for him. And I actually played on the left wing for about 15 minutes.
Why did Niall get subbed?
I have no idea. You don't question George. You just... do as you're told.
Okay, right.
And anyway, I wanted to play, so I wasn't too worried at the time. And then my first full day was Portsmouth away.
Oh yeah, Fratton Park. That's the team I support. Portsmouth.
Yeah, so,
what was that like?
It was what I class as your full debut, isn't it?
Some place to do it as well, because noisy down there, isn't it?
Close it's good. There's certain stadiums you want to go and play at if you could regularly, because how intimidating it was, but the noise, that sort of. As for me, it sort of tests you as a player as well. So it was, and then obviously going on the way that we won the league at Anfield with the circumstances around that.
What's your memory of that moment?
Well, I said to you, I remember listening to Liverpool playing West Ham when the goals were all flying in. The realisation that we've got to go to Anfield on the last game of the season and win. And in the end, I had to turn the radio off because I was thinking, if they score again here, we've got to, not only, it got to two, and we're thinking, so we've gone from, we've got to win, and then all of a sudden I'm listening to it, we've got to win by two. And then I'm thinking, if they score again, win by three goals at Anfield.
Not happening.
Not, even two's just like people saying, you crackers, it's just never going to happen.
Yeah.
History tells you that we did. So I just turned the radio off and put it back on, teletext later on, and see that scoreline finished the same. So we had to win by two goals. But that the build-up to that game was just incredible, where we took the flowers out before the game.
Yeah.
The noise inside there was electrifying.
Yeah.
Against a really strong Liverpool team that very rarely lost at home.
Yeah.
I don't think many people expected us to win, to be quite honest.
Perry Groves said it when I asked him, it was all about his decoy run for the winner. That's typical Perry, isn't it?
Yeah. It's all about Perry, isn't it? He's big enough, bold enough to tell everybody it's about him.
Yeah, right. So that must have been an incredible experience, obviously, to win the league, and the celebrations were pretty good, were they?
Yeah, I can't remember them. So
really? Okay.
Everyone keeps telling me that, well, they certainly lasted for a few days, that's for sure.
How do you look back on the so-called drinking culture at Arsenal at that time?
It was just part of football. We were no different, I don't think, to any other team.
Why do you think more was made of it? Because of what Tony's come out and said afterwards?
Yeah, I think so, because of what happened with Tony, through him going into prison as well, he's set up his charity as well, and with what happened to him, such a high profile player as well. But I don't believe we were any different to most Premier League teams. I simply don't think we could have been. I also don't think you would. It's almost like looking today and picking a team and going, right, all those are going to go out and drink all through the week, and the rest are just going to be in the modern world, and then you go and compete against them and tell me that they'll win the league. It just wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
I just don't, your fitness levels just wouldn't happen. So a lot of teams were doing it. But what I will say to you too is that it gave us a great team spirit. It pulled us together. You know, do I think we were doing anything wrong? No, we weren't, because we didn't have a game the next day. I know Tony's talked about a lot of stuff that he did in the lead up to the games, but I simply don't know whether that was true, because I wasn't around. But we went, Tuesdays we went out drinking, but we were usually off on Wednesday. So
you couldn't do it now though, could you?
No, I don't think you could. No, I don't think you could do it. I just talked about that. Do the guys still have a drink? Yes, they do. Do they have a drink to the level that some of the guys in my team that I was playing with drink? No.
Okay. Certainly not.
Not even I was drinking at that level.
No. The game's changed a lot since then anyway.
Yes, it has. Yeah.
Well, and your England debut came around this time. Is it in the lead up to the World Cup in 1990? Must be a proud moment for you.
Bobby Robson was called. I got a call up to, and came on a sub against Italy.
Yeah.
So that was a very, very proud moment for me. And I mean, I only made two appearances for England, two subs, and the other one was against Germany. So two fantastic teams. Mm. I think I knew, if you like, along my journey in professional football, and particularly with Arsenal, because if you're going to succeed on the international stage, then it's going to be while you're playing at your club,
yeah,
and your club's very successful. And I think I knew very, very quickly that I wasn't going to get a lot of caps for England.
How did you? Well, because of Stuart Pearce. And
Stuart Pearce was there, and they always seemed to pick someone as a backup ahead of me.
Tony DiRigo a lot.
Tony DiRigo was there. Then Graham Lassow,
yeah,
sort
of course.
Came
yeah.
along. So in the end, if I'm honest, I never even. To start with, when we really started to do well at Arsenal, then obviously I was waiting for the squad to come out with a bit of anticipation to think, God, I've got to have a chance of getting into the squad this time.
Yeah,
and then I didn't get in. And
did you get annoyed? Upset? Or what would you?
Annoyed? No, just frustrated.
Yeah.
But then I didn't even look for the squads.
Right.
I didn't even bother looking.
You still support England?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And I'm so proud of making two appearances, one for, I think it was 20-odd minutes and one for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, there's still two caps for England that people would dream about.
Yeah, you never take that away from you. Yeah.
No, I wouldn't. And I always say, when people say to you, what about regrets? And I'm saying, if I could have just started one game for England, that would have been my... That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Just to show you're good enough to play. If you're not, you can accept it. But getting 22 minutes and 45 minutes, you're really not going to.
You're just a bit unlucky,
that.
Right? Because you were obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I played in a period where. I mean, I played with Stuart at West Ham as well. He went in as a third centre half, and I played left wing back. Mm. I mean, it's tremendous. Even when we're talking about the ages that we joined,
yeah.
I mean, his passion and desire was similar to mine.
Mm.
And so, you know, you stand when someone's got the similar thing to you, is no messing.
Yeah.
You know, you stand up and you look at those guys. So you think, quite his peak.
So you weren't looking at Stuart Pearce, obviously, thinking, God, I'm much better than him. You were just thinking, this is fair.
You never judge.
Yeah.
I would never judge somebody like that. So in the end, it was quite clear that the managers that were in charge of England at that time. Preferred another player to you. In fact, two, because there was usually two left backs in the squad.
Yeah.
And it's hard to accept. Mm. You just have to try and get on with it. And then the best way that I dealt with, for me, dealing with it was that I didn't even look at the squads.
Right. Okay.
And that's just the way that I just sort of put it to the back of my mind. But you know, the most important thing for me was you were in professional football and I was at Arsenal, I'm playing at a high level.
Yeah.
I physically cannot do any more.
No.
So if somebody doesn't fancy you as a player, there's little you can...
There's no point worrying about something you haven't got control over.
You haven't got control over it. Yeah. Now, I'm playing as well as I can play, as long as I'm doing everything I can do to be to be where I want to be, then you can't worry if somebody doesn't like you or... Doesn't pick you for a squad, because it can just drive you mad.
I remember asking Ray Parler a similar question. He was rather less charitable than you've been. So good on you for being philosophical about it, I think. Ray was upset about not being in the World Cup in 98 in a big way. Because you guys had won the double that, or they had won the double that year.
Yeah, but I think Ray had been involved in the squads...
Leading up to it,
where I've never really been involved.
Right, okay. So it's a bit different.
Well, if I'd have been part of the England team and I'd have been left out the final squad, cut at the final squad, then I think I might have been a little bit more bitter.
Fair enough.
I never felt that my England career really took off.
Right.
So I've got no reason to be bitter.
Yeah, okay.
Or, you know, just a little, there was a little bit of frustration there, but that's life. It's not too terrible, is it?
No, it's not. And, fair enough. On your famous intensity again, I wanted to ask you about that big bust up against Man United, where you kind of flew in and got a kick in the head for your trouble as well, I think.
Well, that was...
How do you feel about that now, looking back on it?
Laugh.
Do you?
Yeah. It was part of the game, wasn't it?
You're putting a marker down there, aren't you, in a big game?
Yeah, but I think the build-up to it was before that, and Brian McLeod missed a penalty in a cup game at Highbury.
Yeah.
I thanked him for it. He didn't like it.
Yeah.
And then it sort of it sort of kicked off a little bit from there. Then in the next few games, there just happened to be an incident. I mean, people talk about it and say it's like you started it. Well, that's fair. If you want to say that, you know, if that's what people want to say, it's fine. But I think for me, it was the intensity between, I've talked about it quite a bit, the two teams. Manchester United were the team. They were the top team. They had the top players. They were the team winning everything. And I was in an Arsenal team that was coming up that a couple of times challenged them, overtook them, and then they came back at us. The rivalry was like two juggernauts going head to head, and not one of those two teams was going to budge.
Yeah, okay.
You know, they both believed they were the best.
Yeah. This was in 91 when you won the league again, wasn't it?
Yeah. And then that's the incident there where we lost the points.
Yeah.
Was the tackle.
That's right. Yeah.
On Dennis.
Someone takes a right swing for you after that. I think they kick you in the back of the head.
Yeah, I think Paul Ince gave me a little kick.
Yeah.
To be quite honest, I was lying on the ground and I think Paul Ince gave me a kick. Someone else might have given me a little kick. But I mean, I think we got back in dressing rooms. I was laughing about it. It's like,
so none of this spilled over into sort of everyday life then? If you saw one of them in the street, walking down the street,
I'd go and say hello.
Right, okay.
I mean, I don't know how they would react, but it's part of football where, for me, it was like you're almost trying to intimidate the opposition to forget about how good they are.
Yeah.
And try and put them off their game a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to win. You try and keep it within the laws of the game.
Yeah.
But
Nigel, when I look at it now, I mean, obviously I watched a lot of stuff in preparation for this. It's quite interesting because I'm 38, so I remember that vaguely. But when you watch it now, when you're so used to watching Premier League football in 2019-18, it's kind of shocking.
But it was
very intense and very aggressive and very physical.
Yeah, but
I'm not saying it's wrong.
No, I think then there was a lot more of those incidents in football. Does it set a good precedent for kids? No, it doesn't. But I think sometimes as everyone talks about, the red mist comes over.
Yeah.
The intensity of the game, you lose. I've said it on many, many occasions. I've gone home. In my whole career, I think I've been involved in maybe two, maybe three incidents when I've gone home after the game and thought, you absolute idiot.
Really?
Why did you get involved in that?
Yeah.
And as you say, anybody that knows me really well will say, what were you doing? That's just not you.
Yeah.
But then when they know what I'm like when I play football, they go, I see why you were involved in that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's sort of a bit like, but when it's just like I'm a different person. I look at home and I see that and I look at it and I think, why did you do that?
You didn't get sent off for that, did you? Yellow?
You can't get... Yeah, how can you get sent off for getting booted in the back?
Yeah.
It was just a mistimed chat. It was nothing malicious.
No, it's quite a bad tackle, though.
In those days, was it a bad tackle? No,
maybe
I don't think it
maybe
was.
Not.
But if you looked at it today, people would go, well, that's a red card. But the game's different now.
Yeah,
you
course.
Can't judge.
No, of course not.
You can't judge the game now from now to how we play. So,
and there was a big brawl afterwards, and there were fines.
I think we lost maybe two points.
Right.
I think Man United lost a point. I can't remember now.
Yeah.
But it's not something you really want to be involved in. But if you think about, if you realise the intensity of those games and, like, as I said to you, United were the team. We wanted to be that team. It's going to flare up occasionally because two big teams believe in they're the best. And as I say, on many, many occasions, that intensity continued long after I left.
Yeah, it did.
So I can't take all the blame.
No, absolutely
I'll take
not.
The start of it, but I'm not taking the end.
Okay, all right, that's fair enough. Well, so when I want to fast forward now to when Arsene Wenger joined Arsenal because you have the kind of interesting honour of playing under a coach like Dave Bassett and then playing under someone at the opposite end of the spectrum in Arsene Wenger. And you've spoken quite a lot, actually, about what it was like when Wenger came in and how different it was. I mean, you said, I absolutely loved his training methods. I thought they were fantastic. They were quite intense. Everything was on the clock. And if everything was done for a reason, it felt like a new start for everybody. And a lot's made of how Arsene Wenger revolutionising this football, really, not just at Arsenal, but in the Premier League. When you were so up close and personal to that, how does it feel to you looking back on it?
Well, a lot of people talked to me about what he did. Obviously, a lot of people latched on to stopping the drinking culture. Like,
yeah.
So around the games, the bar was closed. The players' lounge was no beer, nothing. But and then changing all the dietary requirements of the players, the things that are like boiled chicken, plain fish.
How receptive to you to that were you at the time?
That sort of thing, if I'm honest, didn't bother me.
Right.
Because it was there at the training ground. But when I went home, I ate basically what I wanted to eat. I'm not, you know, listen, I've got a sweet tooth.
You're quite a good Nick Naller, to be fair.
Yeah, no, but I like cakes.
But other Arsenal players I've asked have said, do you know what? He put years on my career.
For me, I always talk about the training. It was a freshness. It was a different, short and sharp, intense. And when a manager comes and it's so simple in a way, you do a pre-season training session, 6 weeks, and you put the running on. And what Arsene Wenger did is he'd split you into small groups. And let's say we were doing 800 metre runs or even 100 metre runs. He put those players into groups, and then you were on a scale as you went down. So obviously I was in the last group, the oldest group.
Right.
And what he would do is he would adjust your time to the distance you had to cover.
Right, okay.
So his reasoning was that is if, let's say, I'm 33, 34, 35, and you're asking me to run at the same pace as Vieira, Henri, at their age, then I'm obviously working so much harder than they are working.
So it doesn't make any sense, basically.
So it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
We all want to be at the same level through the pre-season going into the first game. Level at peak fitness. If I'm having to work so much harder than those guys, I'm probably going to be over-peaked. I'm going to be shattered by the time that maybe even the first game comes, but halfway through the season, I'm going to be maybe blown out.
And he gave you a football as well in pre-season.
It makes a surprise playing football. You get, we did a lot of...
But that's traditionally, you wouldn't have had that.
No, we used to do, Wimbledon, we'd do 10 days, maybe even 2 weeks, solid running without a ball.
Yeah.
I mean, first, when Arsene Wenger, even with George Graham, we did maybe a week, we did very little touch football. Arsene Wenger, first training session was so light. It was incredible first day. And then in the afternoon, out on the pitch, the balls are all out there and everyone was like, what the heck's going on here? But it's just, but we did do some of the running was based around your position, what you were trying to achieve in your position, but high intensity with the ball. So little short passes, little bursts, and then finishing with a cross into the box for a forward to finish, which is after you've done a little bit of intense work, can you produce the quality of the cross for the finish for the forward? So for me, it was just like a breath of fresh air. I was just like...
Phew. Were you cynical of his background when he first came over?
I didn't care less.
Right.
Well, I think if you ask most players about when managers come and go from a football club, if they're ruthless, and most of them are, they might be quite, in a way, I don't say sad, but disappointed the manager's left.
Yeah.
But once a new manager comes in, the focus for that player is make sure you're in the team.
But if he came in and he was a massive letdown and he never actually won you over with his methods and stuff, presumably you're not going to...
You're not going to respond to it, but you're probably going to find yourself out the door very quickly as well.
Yeah.
So, but I just... To me, it was just so different to what I'd been used to.
Yeah.
And as I say to you, the all the dietary things along the way, you just sort of fall into that a little bit. And a lot of the stuff... people talk about the pills and different things we used to take. I never used to take anyway because I had such a bad stomach. I never took half of that stuff.
Right.
And the thought of someone in putting some vitamins, injecting some vitamins into me with a needle is the last thing I
don't want to know. Okay. No, he didn't make you do it.
No. You were told what they were.
Yeah.
It was there. And the doctor would tell you what they were, or if there was tablets for recovery after, or different things. It was there. It was told what it was, and you were never ever pushed to take it. I think I took one on the first day, and it was like I think it was like some sort. It was like for aid in recovery.
Yeah.
And boy, oh boy, it was like, no, that's not for me.
Not for you, okay.
No. And so I never took any of that. For me, it was the training.
Yeah, okay.
And solely the training. Yes, maybe the food while I was in and around the training ground and travelling and playing did help. But for me, I would say 100% definitely training.
And what did you make of some of the players that were brought to the club around that time? I know Bergkamp came a bit earlier, but I mean, it must have been amazing to be in, because you were, what, 33 when he came in?
Yeah, pushing on.
Yeah, so but it must have been amazing to have all those players around as well.
Yeah, I think once you see the quality, and I talk about it quite a lot, with the quality of those players that come in, when you obviously I didn't know a lot about them, but when you watch them train and play, I mean, he brought in really, the first players that he brought in was more of the attacking.
You were hoping he wasn't bringing a left back in, right?
I was praying.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure, because there were some rumours going around that he'd been told that he needed to disband the back four and start to rebuild. But
yeah.
I think once you know Arsene Wenger, you know that he's his own man. He's not going to be told what to do.
Did you get on well with him personally?
I got on very well with him. Yeah. He's an absolute gentleman. He hated confrontation.
Yeah.
And if he left, he started to leave, obviously at the end, started to leave me out of the team, and he just wouldn't look at you.
Really? Okay.
He just named the team and he didn't want to look at you because he knew that I'd be fuming.
Would you not prefer him just to come and speak to you straight though?
No, I think I got to accept what Arsene Wenger was all about.
Right.
And
you're on board with it.
Yeah. I respected what he was trying to do. I accepted it. I say I was accepting it, and I wanted to fight against it in terms of level of performance.
Yeah.
But I accepted what and his reasonings were for why he was trying to do what he was trying to do. So
you can't check, you can't question his record either, really, can you?
No, you can't. But and also when you bring in, Anelka, Petit, Vieira, Overmars, and then Henri comes along.
What was that like in training?
It's just sensational. That's just when you see these guys play and you're thinking, well, as a back four we know we can do what we need to do, and then you see these guys coming in front of you, it's just like, I'll just give them the ball and let them get on with it. That was my philosophy in playing anyway. I was so super confident in what I could do defensively. And I was just saying, right, my job's to win the ball, give it to someone more creative than me.
And
that was my philosophy in life in playing football.
You didn't have a problem with that?
Oh, no. Why?
Well, because I think some people have an inflated opinion themselves because they're professional footballers. And no?
No, ability-wise, I was probably be many, many players ahead of me, but it depends how you class ability. If you're classing your ability on defending, then I class myself very, very high in terms of, because I've got to believe I am the best in my position.
Yeah.
But in terms of skill, if you want to look at it in a different way, I just kept it simple.
Yeah.
Win the ball. I know I can win the ball. Yeah. I'll back myself one against one with anybody.
Yeah.
I don't always win those battles, but you'll back yourself. And then when you win the ball, just pass it 5 yards to someone simple. Why do you have to... You become respected from your teammates that you know what job he's going to do. Week in, week out, he's just going to do the same job for you.
Mm.
And I think that's how basically my career was built.
Do you think that's why you're popular with fans as well? Because you're honest, hard-working, intense, and gave it all?
I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fans like that, don't they?
Yeah, they want to see someone that's passionate about their club.
Is that what you want to see as a fan now?
And skill.
Yeah.
I want to see it all.
Okay.
Skill level is different now. The game is not as much tackling. Mm. The game's quicker because the condition of the pitches.
Yeah.
But yeah, I want to see someone that can do, in the position that they're playing, can do their job to the highest of their ability, but doesn't also forget about that the other side of the job is their work rate and their obligation, if you like, to help their teammates out defensively as well. And if I see someone with slightly less ability but is doing that, at times I'd like to see them in the team as well.
Yeah, okay. And I want to ask you about Play With A Legend, because you do a bit of that now, where people can organise events and they can play with legendary players such as yourself, Nigel. Yeah. But if I may call you a legendary player while you're here, I don't want to embarrass you. But
you could call me what you like.
But I'm kind of scared to now, because I think, are you as intense on Play With A Legend as you are?
Yes.
Are you really? Okay.
Yeah.
So you barking orders? Are you hassling people?
Just trying to... So we when you play with a legend, obviously you're playing with a group of guys. Obviously, it's usually it may be a stag or a birthday. Yeah. It may even be corporate.
Yeah.
And it's usually around but one person. So, you know, that person obviously supports Arsenal, but the rest of the guys, some support Arsenal, but you've got a load that support different teams.
Mm.
And you try when you come up. I just try when I'm in the teams. If we sometimes we'll swap teams as well.
Yeah.
And I just try and organise them, talk to them, just try and show them what it's like when you're playing at a professional level.
Do you still enjoy it, doing it?
Yes. Yeah. And particularly the better they are. The more,
you just love playing football, right?
Yeah. The better they are, the more I like it, particularly if they then think they want to try and show you a little bit. Then it becomes interesting.
Okay, right.
Yeah, so I play to their level. Unless someone wants to get a bit cheeky.
Any reducers go in if they need it?
I don't think I sort of would call what I've reduced someone, but I've left a little bit on a couple of players who have left a bit on me first.
Okay, right.
So, yeah, if they want to mix it a little bit. But then after, we'll go and
have a beer.
Go and have a beer and a laugh about what's happened, and then just talk about different things people are interested to see. And then they find out that actually I'm probably... a completely different person to the one that's been perceived in by certain supporters.
Yeah.
But that's part of life, isn't it? That's personal part of being in professional sport. A lot of people don't know me. You're judged on what you do in your career.
The public eye, yeah. How do you look back on your career, Nigel? And you're very proud of what you've achieved? Is there any regrets or anything like that?
No. I always say that I'm being lucky, privileged to get to do something I wanted to do. And hopefully didn't waste that opportunity, which I think some people do.
Yeah, but you haven't. Definitely not. With 700 odd games or whatever it is, more than that probably.
There's a lot. I don't. As I say to you, I don't know the exact figure because I don't look you know, it's just a case of, you know, I knew. From my point of view, is one was from that very, very first outset at Birmingham, getting the opportunity to be an apprentice, which could lead to being a professional player, was the spark for me.
That fueled you, yeah.
And then from that bit, your aim is to be, I wanted to be the chosen player in my one position, turned out to be left back.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was going to be left back, but that's where it really evolved for me, is do everything that you can to be the number one pick for whatever manager you're playing in front of. And if I say, I was very, very lucky throughout my career. Most of the time, apart from a couple of small periods, I usually became a first choice pick. So that makes me very, very proud as well. But I still love it. I still go and watch. I'm still passionate about Arsenal and still want them to get back to where they were when I was playing with the trophies we won, but also the teams that I went and watched after I'd finished, you know, I left in 2000, but also from 2000, 2006 was a sensational period for them. And then hopefully one day I'll be sitting there watching them, but they've got to get a move on because I'm 55 now.
Well, Nigel, you're a lovely, lovely man. I've enjoyed your company a great deal. Thank you very much for giving up your time today.
No, it's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me in.
Thanks.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.